Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. Here, the result is always positive. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, we will discuss the mysteries of the universe. When we are done, you will never look at the stars or yourself the same again. Whether you are in a truck headed for the coast or in a car coming home from the beach or listening in your garage as you work on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about where you came from and why you are here and where you are going than you thought possible. In here, your potential is absolutely unlimited. Tonight on X Squared Radio, we're going to discuss, in our cosmology section, the moon mission controversy. Recently, NASA made the announcement that in 2018, the intention is NASA is going to return to the moon with a manned mission. And of course, this brought up a lot of old stories and a lot of old conspiracy theories about that we possibly never went to the moon in the first place. Now, yes, I remember those stories my mother-in-law told me about 20 years ago, why we never went to the moon. That was all faked down there in Hollywood. Well, of course, I naturally debated her because I'm a firm believer that we did go to the moon. However, recently, I say recently, in the last 3 years, there have been a couple of specials on. One, June 2nd, 2004, the UK terrestrial TV station 5 broadcast a documentary in its Stranger Than Fiction series called The Truth Behind the Moon Landings. And then there was a second broadcast on Fox, which we probably know a little bit more about. It was on February 15th, 2001, a little earlier than that, about 4 years before. And it was re-aired on March 21st. And it was also trying to expose some of the claims that we never went to the moon. They made the claim that the moon shots were faked. So we're going to have a discussion about that. And in our Nephilim section tonight, we are going to discuss the ancient offspring of the Nephilim, which were the giants. Now, there's so much evidence of their existence and their influence on many ancient civilizations and their encounters with other world-famous explorers, it is hard to believe that people still don't believe they exist. We'll share some of that evidence with you tonight. First, we need to pay a little bill. The Ark of Millions of Years is the greatest story on the universe. Volume 1 solves the mystery of evolution and creation once and for all. In its 530 pages, you will learn about the origin and destiny of the Earth. You will learn about the ancient giants. You will learn about man's long history of interaction with off-worlders. You will learn the common origin of many of mankind's most powerful religious symbols. When you are done with that book, you will never look at the stars, your scriptures, or yourself the same again. It's available at www.arkofmillionsofyears.com. Make sure you spell that A-R-K, like Noah's Ark, or your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth bookstores. And recently, they are now available at Davis Kidd booksellers. So now we will begin our cosmology section, and I would like to introduce to you one of my one of the greatest explorers I've ever known. We have hiked through some of the most amazing discoveries in the mountains surrounding East Tennessee, and we've had many life experiences in the wilderness, amazing experiences not only with stars and with meteor showers, but also with natural phenomena. I would like to introduce to you Dean Ford. Good evening, Dean.
Hey, how you doing, buddy? Glad to be on.
This is great. So how are things in Bays Mountain, Tennessee?
Well, things are really great here at Bays Mountain. We've had a pretty exciting day. On the way home from my job today, I was looking in the sky. It's a pretty sunset with just very few clouds, and got to see a very fast aircraft that, I've got about 2 flight hours, and I've never witnessed an aircraft move so fast, and I don't believe for a minute it was a UFO or anything like that, but I do think it might be one of our new experimental aircraft. It blazed across the sky. It was higher than cirrus clouds.
And wow, amazing.
Probably about 30 degrees in just moments.
Amazing. One of the things we also notice in the mountains of East Tennessee, because we have great dark sky country, is occasionally we get a good view at the Aurora Borealis. Yes, even as far south as Tennessee. So I think last November we saw an amazing one, and it's about that time of year again. We should be able to see them.
If the sun cooperates, we'll see another one.
Yes. Well, we're supposed to be entering a quiet time with the sun. Now, we covered that a couple of weeks ago on this program. We covered the habits, or at least the cycles, that solar physicists think they figured out about our sun, and the radiation given off by solar flares that occur, it seems, when there is a plethora of sunspots. However, we are entering a period of very quiet time for the sun, in that there are not very many sunspots. But that didn't stop 9 X-class flares from occurring a short time ago. All right, well, tonight we're going to talk about the moon mission controversy. And Dean has agreed to be the advocate for NASA tonight. And I have agreed to try to, as intelligently as I can, without laughing, explain to you some of the concerns that not necessarily conspiracy theorists, but certainly people that have done what seems to be a fairly honest analysis of the data that was presented, namely pictures and videos brought back from the moon. So I want to talk a little bit about the UK's terrestrial TV broadcast, The Truth Behind the Moon Landings. It seems as though they made some inquiries to the McDonald Observatory on Mount Livermore. This is near Fort Worth, Texas. I know a little bit about that area. I just finished a four-month contract down there. I can tell you that from the ground, there are no stars in Texas. You have to have an observatory to be able to see them. And I want to try to bring in a little bit of personal evidence that I received in conversations that I overheard at a presentation where Buzz Aldrin actually spoke about his experience on the moon. And maybe a little bit of his testimony from that. So let's get into the meat of it here. Now, of course, my mother-in-law, 20 years ago, said to me, "We never went to the moon. That was all faked down there in Hollywood." And, of course, my immediate rebuttal was, "Now, Ruth," that's my mother-in-law's name, "you know that there are laser reflectors that we have placed up there on the moon and during our missions up there, and actually there are 4 sets of them, and we occasionally fire lasers at those, and we measure the distance between the Earth and the moon. Now, if we never went to the moon, how in the world did those reflectors get there?" Now, that was my argument until I read the transcript from this UK special. It appears that the detractors, made some inquiries to a Mr. Jerry Wyant, and he was interviewed. He's the chief engineer from McDonald Observatory on Mount Livermore near Fort Worth, Texas. Now, this observatory is one of those responsible for getting the laser readings from what they call retro reflectors, allegedly placed on the lunar surface by the astronauts. And according to their documentary, which is more specifically referred to, I guess, as the 1969 Apollo 11 manned mission. This act demonstrated absolutely that NASA got its astronauts, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, onto the surface. Now, you would think that we should be able to ask some pretty precise questions about that data. And indeed, they did ask questions of Mr. Wyant. And these are the questions that they asked. Now, I want you to kind of listen to these questions and see if they wouldn't be the kind of questions you would ask for if you really sat down and had a chance to script something to ask Mr. Wyant. They asked for confirmation of the exact day that the observatory, this is the McDonald Observatory, had picked up the laser reflector on the Apollo 11 site. Now, you have to understand how they did this. They used the 100-inch reflector at the McDonald Observatory as a focuser, and they fired a laser at the reflectors and then caught the reflection of the laser back with the telescope. And this is what they allegedly measured the distance, the Earth-Moon distance. They wanted to know the exact date that they did this. Now, it shouldn't be a very hard question. They also asked for more precision concerning the rate of movement per year of the moon away from the Earth. It's a well-known, that the Earth is, or the moon is moving away from the Earth. And it's kind of a controversy as to whether it's 4 millimeters or 4 centimeters. 4 centimeters is about, 2.5 inches, something like that. They also requested that that they inform as to which one of the reflectors that they're using, and also whether they're using center-to-center or surface-to-surface measurements. Maybe that's not so important. But then they also wanted to know what were the nearest and furthest distances that have been measured. In other words, how far has the moon moved since 1969? Well, what kind of reply do you think they got? None. Mr. Jerry Wyant didn't respond. Well, what do you normally do when you send an email and no one responds?
Well, normally I send it back.
Yeah, send another email. Hey, did you get my email? And that's exactly what they did, and he responded immediately back and said, yes, I did get your last note, but it is beyond my knowledge. I forwarded your questions to Pete. I will ask him if he got them. And Jerry signed his message with a small J, and that was the last they ever heard of him. Now, they, you know, followed up, of course, and didn't really get any information from those questions, which I thought was a little strange. I really thought that they should have gotten some answers from those questions. Now, as it turns out, Pete, if I can find it here in my stack of stuff here, Pete is actually on the staff, and he did not directly answer them either. His name is Dr. Pete Shellus, S-H-E-L-U-S. Let's see here. They, as of June of 2004, had not provided any information back to this inquiry. Now, I must admit that sometimes these inquirers can sound a little bit like science fiction nuts or conspiracy theorists, and we real scientists don't really like to be bothered with such people. So I will give you, you may not have an ability to respond to that, Dean, but here are 5 questions that I think you probably could respond to. The number one point that they had here, Mary Bennett actually makes this point in her book called Dark Moon, Apollo and the Whistleblowers. Now, you can tell that they probably sold a lot of books because this is a very popular subject, and they wrote it hard.
Sounds like it's got one of the right 8 words to get a book sold.
Yes. Yes. The bigger the juggernaut you take on, and the more outlandish your claims of conspiracy, the better your profits will be.
That's correct.
Number one, they want to investigate why NASA chose to present the Apollo scenario, with which we are all familiar, when research evidence suggests that a parallel operation was actually executed. Now, that's a pretty outlandish claim. According to Mary Bennett, she claims that although we may have actually gone to the moon, the photographic evidence that was returned was too good. In fact, it was studio quality, and so she believes that even though we probably did go, why did NASA go through the trouble of faking all the photographs?
Well, my rebuttal to that would be this. Of course, if I was out taking pictures, you know, I do a little photography on the side, I take a lot of pictures, and the ones that are the best are the ones that I keep. The ones that don't look good, I don't usually, you know, keep or get reprinted.
And how many pictures do you recollect that they took on the moon?
Oh, thousands.
I think it's something like over 80,000 pictures.
Yeah. And how many have you ever seen in your life?
Well, I have a good friend, Mr. Blair Newsom, whose mother worked for NASA, retired from NASA, and had quite an impressive internal collection of NASA memorabilia. Not the kind of stuff you find on eBay. These were the originals, with original signatures on them from original astronaut teams.
Oh, that would have been fun to look through that.
Very impressive. I was humbled just to leaf through it. But what I saw was an impressive, crystal clear set of photographs taken on the surface of the moon with a Hasselblad camera with a regular 160 speed film, and it was very impressive. Every shot was crystal clear and very impressive.
Well, you can imagine, you know, if they were going to go to the trouble of sending someone to the moon, this is, you know, not something you're going to do every day. So you're going to minimize the amount, that no room for error. So like you're talking about a Hasselblad, I'd say most people aren't even familiar with the type of camera that is. But, you know, luckily I've had some friends that are professional photographers, and that is the camera to get if you're going to do any photography. And they're extremely expensive, and especially the one that they took to the moon. It had to be manufactured to where they could use it, you know, inside their space suits. And, you know, as a matter of fact, they were attached to the front of the space suit, so they just stand there like, you know, you and me taking pictures of mom and dad, you know, with your gloved hands. You know, so they were really special cameras. And so, of course, they came out, you know, with a really good product.
I like that argument. I like that argument. All right, number two, one of the things that you notice in the photographs are some of the shadows behind the rocks are just jet black. I mean, so black you can't see any detail at all. However, other things like the spacesuit and the lunar lander and the flag and some of the other things seem to show additional lighting used. Even though there was no additional lighting taken to the moon, some of these photographs show impossibly high photographic viewpoints and additional lighting, even though the cameras, as you say, were attached to the astronauts' chest brackets. So, and I do see several pictures, and we'll post these on the X Squared Radio website later this week, and you'll be able to view them. Even though these pictures do seem to show this, what is the explanation?
Well, you know, really, that was one of the first things that really intrigued me when I did some research on this subject. And I looked at several pictures, and of course, on the Internet, sometimes you can believe some things, sometimes you can't. And I got to some pretty good sites and with some reliable photography on it. And the explanation for that is simply scattered light. You know, you can imagine in the airless void of space like you got on the moon, you know, it does have some atmosphere, although, you know, very, very little, you know, despite what most people believe. The scattered light from the gray dust would light up the front of the suit, whereas with the direct light going down like on a rock, immediately behind that rock, you know, would not have as much scattered light blasting back into it, so it seems, you know, inky blackness back behind that. Whereas, you know, the surface of the lunar lander, you know, and the surface of the, you know, spacesuits for the astronauts, which are, you know, really white, you know, they would have some scattered light, which would soften the shadows.
Well, I know one thing about the photographs is that they were all pretty much taken during the lunar day, even though the sun was low in the horizon.
Well, that's a fact, because they couldn't really withstand like noon on the moon because of the temperatures and stuff like that.
I understand it gets around 250 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, correct.
However, that isn't all that hot. I've been in a sauna before that was 250 degrees, and I could stay in there with my bare skin probably 15 or 20 minutes. And I'm sure with an atmospherically controlled space suit and gold film over the front of the visor, I could probably take 250 degrees for half a day,
yeah.
which they probably were able to do. I'm sure those suits could take a lot more temperature than that.
Oh, yeah, that's
and
nice.
And so what you're saying is the same moon that lights up our deserts in the middle of the night when the sun reflects off of it, even though the moon is 275,000 miles away, is the same reflection that lights up the shadow side of these spacesuits and the shadow side of the lunar lander.
That's correct. Yeah.
What a great explanation.
Makes sense, don't
it? It makes a lot of sense. All right.
Why do I detect there's a zinger coming here at me?
Yes. All right. Let's see here. How about the explanation of going through the Van Allen radiation belts? Now, of course, the Russians were quite afraid of this. Somewhere around between 6,000 and 40,000 miles surrounding the Earth is a ring known as the, a sphere known as the Van Allen radiation belts. They were discovered by Van Allen. These are quite intense X-rays and cosmic rays, and the contention was made by the detractors that a dose like this would be lethal and it would kill all the astronauts before they made it through it.
Yeah, I've heard that before, too. Yeah, but there is a good explanation for that. You know, you as a physicist, you know that the Van Allen radiation belt is really donut-shaped, right?
Yes.
Thinner in some spots that it is in that they went through to get to the moon, actually some of the thinnest parts of the radiation belt, so their exposure was limited that way.
Mm-hmm. And how long did they spend in this exposure range?
Pardon me?
How long did the craft, as it was traveling through space, how long did it stay inside the peak zone of the Van Allen radiation belt?
Well, just a second. As a matter of fact, I had that in my notes. Let me just... I don't know if I like to listen to somebody.
Well, while he's looking for that in his notes, I'll let you know a little bit about cosmic radiation. X-rays are the same rays that you get exposed to when you go to the doctor to have your teeth X-rayed or your bones X-rayed, or you have drink that is chalky stuff and have an X-ray of your entrails. And what the X-rays do is they actually sputter off electrons, and new electrons take their place, and they release a fluoresced X-ray, and that's X-ray fluorescence. The kind of X-ray that's used to expose film, what we find is very dense material absorbs the X-ray rather harmlessly. These are very low doses, and less dense material, like your muscle or your fat, the X-ray just goes right through, kind of like a BB going through a tennis net, striking the film and thus exposing the film into a darker area. So where the X-rays are blocked, the metal halide and the silver halide that's on the film is washed away by the chemical, and where the X-ray passes through, the silver halide cures to the polyester film and stays rather dark. So that's why you see X-rays exposed the way they are. And I might also add that these X-rays do not travel very far without losing energy. In fact, they lose energy with the square of the distance from their origin, which in this case would be the sun. So have you found your...
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I have. And you're quite right, the Van Allen radiation belt extends from about 400 miles up to about 12,000 miles above the Earth.
Okay.
But they only spent about 4 hours total there and back in this region because they were traveling about 25,000 miles an hour.
Exactly. So It's sort of like taking a four-hour X-ray, only at a much, much more dose. Plus, the one thing they had that you don't have when you go get your X-ray is what?
That spacesuit, dude.
And they have a ship around them.
That's exactly right.
And the ship is rather dense, even though a lot of it is aluminum. Most of it was titanium, and that was very effective, especially at blocking high-energy particles, neutrons, and especially alpha particles, alpha radiation, beta radiation. Only the gamma radiation would have made it through, and they would have had a very short exposure. So of the 12 sets of footprints that are on the moon, none of them have died of cancer.
That's right. And that's, as a matter of fact, that's one of the arguments that the people that don't believe we went to the moon, to the moon use, to argue that we didn't go there.
Well, I would think that people that have been to the doctor for 20 or 30 X-rays would stand a better chance of getting cancer than the astronauts did going
completely
to the moon. And I dare say a craft to the moon in 2018 would be capable of traveling safer and far faster than 25,000 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah. Now, imagine, you know, you look at the humankind and the way we've advanced just since the late 1700s. You could take a farmer from the late 1700s and put him in a field next to an Egyptian farmer from, 5,000 years ago. And they pretty much did things the same way. But nowadays, there's a world of difference between that guy in the late 1700s and now.
Well, I just look at the difference between my digital camera from a year ago and my digital camera now.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad I waited before I bought one.
I have a friend who's a professional photographer. He takes pictures for companies, their company picture. And he bought a $10,000 digital camera to do this with a year ago. And he was quite satisfied with the camera, but this year he bought another $10,000 camera. And he said that the camera he bought this year is at least 100 times better than the camera he had last year.
What did he do with his old camera?
Well, yeah, he probably traded it in, I'm not sure. Anyway, let me pay a bill, and then we'll come back and we'll cover a couple more details on this, all right?
Okay, make some money, man.
No matter what church you attend, no matter what your ancestry or your present nationality, you have a history and a lineage of which you might not be aware. You are children of the stars. The real ET is in the mirror. If you want to learn more about where you came from, why you are here, and where you might be going from here, you need to read The Arc of Millions of Years this year. It's available at your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth booksellers. Recently, Davis Kidd booksellers in Nashville, Memphis, Jackson, and other locations. But if you want to get the free audio version of the book, a 5-CD set with the entire book recorded in audio, you can listen to it in your car, truck, or airplane, you should purchase the book at the website at www.arcofmillionsofyears.com. It's free if you buy the hardback. If you bought the book before the audiobook was available, you can request it for free by registering at the website. We will send it to you at no charge on 5 CDs. You can put it in your vehicle and listen to it. All right, we'll cover a couple more points on this moon mission controversy, and then we will move on to our next section. Now, a couple of the other points that were brought out, I think we've pretty much debunked most of them. But one of the things that we want to talk about are the shadows of the rocks compared to the shadow of the lunar lander, compared to the shadow of the astronauts that were standing there. I mentioned earlier that the sun was low in the sky, and so the shadows were long on the planet. We won't go into why or the assertion that the shadows were different lengths, and so that makes it evident that there was a source of light pretty close to the planet. namely a Hollywood light just off camera. But let's talk about the diverging angles of the shadows. Now, the detractors show a couple of photographs of a fairly flat parking lot with some parking lot lights and some planters and things like that, and the fact that all of the shadows are parallel to one another on this surface. Yet when you look at the landscape photos of the moon, where you see Buzz Aldrin saluting the flag, or the shadow of the flag itself, or the rocks, you notice that the angles from each one of these shadows go off in different directions. They're not parallel with one another. It could indicate multiple lighting sources, although I only see one shadow behind each rock and not two, as you would, say, in a gymnasium where there are several lights and you looked at your own shadow on the floor. But the angles are different. So what do you? What is your assertion? What is your defense of that?
Well, the simple fact is, like what you just closed with, whenever you have multiple light sources, you have multiple shadows. There's no getting away from it. It's just basic. You can see that in a gymnasium when you've got all these halide lights over you. And you'll see multiple shadows all over the place, right? And the most pronounced shadow is always the one from the brightest light source. Well, fact of the matter is, there's no shadows like that. And one of the arguments they have is if you look in the visor of the astronaut, you'll see shadows going in different angles. Well, anybody that's ever looked at a visor, and I've had plenty of visors in my time in the military in flight, visors are curved. So that reflection that you see in that visor, shows those shadows, pointing in different directions because it's curved. Were you to take that and flatten it out, they would all point in the same direction.
All
the
right.
Other argument is...
What about the film and the cameras laying flat? Why would the shadows of Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong planting the flag, why would their shadows be in different directions?
Well, simply because the surface of the moon is not flat. If you look at the surface of the moon, and you can imagine, well, you can see it from here, cratering. If the surface of the moon were perfectly flat, you would have shadows all going in the same direction. But since it's sloping away from you in some areas, rising toward you in others, rising away from you in others, the shadows appear to point in different directions, but they're really not.
And one of the things maybe I've noticed too, I'm quite skilled at drawing with AutoCAD, which is pretty easy to do when things are flat. But when things are in perspective, they tend to take on different angles. And so when you're photographing from a single point, this film was 120 millimeters in length, and you're photographing something that may be 400 or 500 yards, it's possible that that perspective coming into the camera would provide for you diverging shadow angles.
That's correct. I think a lot of it's also to do with the lay of the land. I know for a fact here in the eastern part of the United States, when you look at the Smoky Mountains, you can judge distances very well because you've got a lot of terrain features in between you and the faraway mountains. And so you can kind of judge how far those mountains are away from you. But however, when you go out west to like the Rockies, when they jump right up out of the plain, it appears that the Rockies are a lot closer to you than they actually are. And it's just an optical illusion. You get the same kind of effect on the moon.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So I feel a lot of water leaking out of the detractor's bag of tricks here. One final point. There's a final shot taken facing out of the bottom of the lunar module as it takes off from its base on the moon. Below it is the flag, and a crystal clear shot of the surface below, but no dust. So why wouldn't a rocket with a 10,000-pound boost stir up a lot of dust when it took off of the moon?
Well, in fact, it does, okay? But dust reacts different in an atmosphere than it does in no atmosphere. When you blow, like if you had some flour here on your table and you blew on it, it would hang in the air and billow like clouds and such. Well, that's not how it reacts on the moon. It goes in straight lines, you know, away from the, you know, source of thrust. And so
it doesn't swirl.
No, it doesn't swirl like it would here on Earth, you know, like in a helicopter's wake or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
So that's why you don't see that. And as a matter of fact, you can see, if you look closely, those straight lines of the dust jetting away from the lander as it takes off.
I might have to look at the video. I've got a still shot of it.
It's hard to argue these things when, you know, you don't have pictures to show the radio audience, you know, but trust me.
Well, I do know when I was looking at the video of the detractors as they showed their point of the lunar lander, not the lunar, the lunar rover, as it was driving around. One of the things that I noticed that they didn't point out in the video is that the dust being picked up by those wire wheels went straight up in the air and made a perfect parabolic path right back down to the ground.
Ballistic.
Yeah, there was no, like you said, air to swirl it around like behind my truck as I drive down the freeway. Or as, like you mentioned, as a helicopter flies through smoke, you'll see sort of a vortex of swirling around it as the blades of a helicopter beat the air into submission.
Yeah, there's no swirling effect at all. It's just straight line.
Yeah, it just goes straight up, and of course there's some velocity going forward, and so the momentum of it carrying forward mixes with the gravity pulling it back down, and you get a perfect parabolic pattern of this little waterfall of dust going right back down onto the surface.
It amazed me as I did a little research for this, how many, if you'll just look at the resume of the people that detract from the moon landing and look at the resumes of the people that, you know, argue for the moon landing, there's quite a difference. You know, you've got handymen, people that never went to college and stuff like that, that argue against the moon landing. So you can take a little bit of comfort, you know, in the crowd you hang with, okay? You know, so like my aunt, I'll leave her nameless for the moment, that used to tell me that we never went to the moon. You know, she never even graduated high school. And so I tend to side with the people that have at least graduated college.
Well, I certainly don't want to maybe make a detracting statement to anybody just because they haven't completed college.
Well,
but I do take your point very seriously. And you know what this discussion and listeners, what we've done is we've actually concluded that amazingly, 36 years ago plus, men got into a titanium can on top of a liquid rocket, and they flew 1,000,000 miles to the moon, around it and back, landed on the moon, walked around on the moon, filled their satchels with samples of the moon, took almost 100,000 photographs, and returned alive to tell the story.
Fascinating.
I was alive during that day, and I remember watching that landing and hearing those words live on the television when it happened. I can tell you a sense of national pride like this nation has never known since. I hear critics say we should not return to the moon. We should spend our money on problems we have here on Earth. But I can tell you, as I look around my library here, there is scarcely a thing in this room that has not benefited from the space program.
That's the argument right there.
The clothes that I'm wearing, the material that my office chair is made out of, the CRT that I'm looking into right now as we broadcast this radio show, my printer, my digital watch that I have on my hand, all came from the space program. And nothing excites me more than to have a government that's brave enough, bold enough to say, let's go back. we can do it better now. We've got better computers. We have better materials. We can do a multinational effort. And we can find out things on the moon that might be able to help us to save this planet.
If we don't set high standards for ourselves, we'll be mediocre.
Yes, I agree with that. I agree with that. All right, with that, we will conclude our cosmology section. And if you'll hang around, Dean.
I'll hang around.
We'll take another quick commercial here, and then we'll talk about the offspring of the Nephilim.
Okay, that's cool.
The arc of millions of years explains why the Mayan calendar ends at the year 2012. Actually, in December of 2012. Not only that, the detail in the book will help you understand why the Earth is going through such changes right now. Is the Earth really warming? Yes. In fact, all the planets in our solar system are warming. Want to know why? Read the book. Is the Earth from this solar system? No. Want to know the proof? Read the book. Are we alone in the universe? No. Want to know who they are and why they have always been so interested in our planet? Read the book. It's always available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at www.arcofmillionsofyears.com or at your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth bookstores. And recently, you can now pick it up at Davis Kidd Booksellers in Nashville, Memphis, Jackson, Tennessee, and other locations. In addition to that, if you buy the hardback, you will get a 5-CD set of the book in audio, completely free. We will mail it to you, no charge. All right, our section on the Nephilim tonight, we're going to talk about the ancient tribes and civilizations of the giants. Now, the giants were the result of a union between off-worlders, fallen angels, known as the Nephilim. They were also called the Watchers. Enoch says there were about 200 of them, although it appears as though not all 200 were on this planet at one time. Of course, Roslyn Chapel in Roslyn, Scotland. I've been there myself. I've taken photographs of it, and they are all available crystal clear detail on the website, arcofmillionsofyears.com. These Nephilim had, of course, the experience of an immortal, and they also had the wisdom of one who can travel from planet to planet. And they spent their time on this planet, and it appears from evidence in the Bible, in the Kabbalah, in the Zohar, in the Book of Enoch, which was translated from the Slavonic into English in the mid-1700s, that these Nephilim had relations with mortal earth women. In fact, they were enamored by mortal earth women. And unlike our DNA, human DNA cannot mix with any other species. In fact, no species can mix with another species here on this planet. But unlike that DNA, Nephilim DNA can blend with anything and generate offspring. And the offspring result between a Nephilim and a human is a giant. Now, what do I mean by giant? Do I mean individuals 8 feet tall, 10 feet tall, 12 feet tall, 36 feet tall? The answer is yes. How do I know this? Because there is a mountain of physical, modern-day evidence that these individuals, at all of the heights I just mentioned, did in fact exist. So have you ever run into a giant, Dean?
Well, no. As a matter of fact, I've never run into a giant, although I have always been intrigued by the issue. I know that in almost every civilization, there's legends of giants, and like there's a universal legend of the flood. Usually whenever there's a universal legend among different civilizations, there's some truth to it, don't you think?
Right. As it turns out, and we'll talk about that in another show, the universal flood and the common origin of the legend of the flood in almost every civilization, including the American Indian, makes it quite evident that such an event actually happened. But in the case of giants, not only are there carvings in stone, there's tons of artwork, but there's also the testimony of several global travelers that ran into civilizations of giants. One of those individuals was Magellan. Those of you that are in high school geography or history classes will know who Magellan is. He is given the credit, maybe improperly so, but given the credit for being the first man to circumnavigate the globe. Well, in one of his expeditions, landing his boats and picking up supplies, he and his men ran into a tribe of giants. They record these individuals being somewhere between 9 and 12 feet tall, and they were not happy to see them. Fortunately, they had superior weaponry and were, in fear for their lives, so they were able to fight their way back to the ship, not without some loss, but they weren't completely destroyed on either side. So how did these giants get to where they are? How did they spread so widely? How did they proliferate? How long have they been here? Well, we can't answer all these questions tonight, and I will defer to the undisputed champion of knowledge on the giants on the earth, named Stephen Quayle, and I highly recommend the four books that he writes on the subject. I will, on my website, do provide a link to his website. Stephen Quayle has more evidence than you could absorb in half a lifetime. And he graciously licenses some of the photographs to us so that we can help him make his point. One of the things that we go a little bit more into are the tribes of the giants and their interaction, early tribes of men. Now, as I mentioned before, the giants were enamored with earth women. One of the features that they liked about earth women the most was their long hair. And being that the giants, once they, as offspring of the Nephilim, they proliferated, and they were not hybrids, they were able to reproduce, so they took to themselves earthly wives, and as is reported, they had a body temperature of around 115 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, the human has a body temperature of 98.6, plus or minus a degree or so, but that's about the mean temperature of the average human. And you can see how many calories it takes to keep us afloat, right?
Correct.
I mean, it takes at least a happy meal a day for this boy.
Yeah, about 1,700 calories a day, isn't it?
About 1,700 calories a day. Can you imagine how many calories it would take to keep somebody 650 pounds heavy, can run as fast as a horse, cleave a man in two with a single blow of a sword, can yell so loudly that objects can actually levitate. It's called harmonic levitation. This much energy requires a lot of food.
Oh, yeah.
So part of the job of the mortal or normal height people, part of their job as a commute is to feed the giants. And one of the things that, and I'm going to use the word ancient rather loosely, but one of the things that medieval or pre-medieval communities did is they usually picked the biggest guy in camp and made him the king.
Makes sense.
Such was the case with Charlemagne. Charlemagne was reported to be 7'2" and weighed around 400 pounds. Now, he's, of course, battle-hardened, very intelligent, so feared by the church that he was crowned king by the Holy Roman Emperor, as a Holy Roman Emperor, against his will, they crowned him. He did not want to be king. He knelt, and they put the crown on him, deceiving him. But in any case, this guy was very large, and of course was undefeatable. He could just wade through hundreds of men that weighed, 100 pounds, 105 pounds, barely 5 feet tall.
Well, the average height of people back then was considerably shorter than they are now. We've gained height.
Sure. But you take somebody that's 7'2" in a sea of people that weigh 5 feet.
Oh, he's a monster.
Yes. And I heard that his sword weighed upwards of 40 pounds.
He You've could got wield swords it. In your collection at your house. What's
yeah. Well, the only way they ended up defeating him was by shooting arrows from a high vantage point down into his collar from up above. And evidently there were hundreds of archers doing this, and they finally were able to defeat him. But also the Romans came up against giants as they ventured up into the German areas and the Ukraine. They ran across tribes of giants. And, of course, the giants summarily wiped out the first few armies they sent up there. And when you have somebody that can yell at 150, 155 decibels in a pitch that is absolutely blood-curdling, and he stands 9 feet or 12 feet or 15 feet tall, that's pretty imposing.
Oh, yeah.
When the average Roman soldier, even in really good shape, was probably about 5'5".
That's right.
And so the Romans developed some weapons. They had war engines. They could fire a bolt like a spear, but it was blunt. That is to say, it had iron fins on the back of it. It had a sort of like a duck point on the front of it, not a real sharp point.
Like a spade.
Well, yeah, specifically because in their experiments, the real sharp ones would go straight through, but the blunt ones would do enough damage that they could take down a giant. And they would haul these engines all by hand, by horseback, all the way up into the mountains of the Ukraine and around the Rhine River and fight these giants, draw them out into the open, and shoot them with these bolts. These weapons were developed specifically to kill giants, not to knock down castle walls. And so they became giant killers. And one of the other practices that was taking place as people figured out where giants came from, they came from giant babies, is many of the societies made it illegal to have relations, sexual relations, with these giants. And further, it became customary to cover women's heads so that their hair would not be exposed. And it actually says in the Old Testament that the women were to cover their heads so as not to tempt the angels.
It does, in fact. I've read that.
It does, in fact, say that. And there were even some other tribes that were successful in keeping their genes clean and pure, of having giant or Nephilim DNA mixed with it. And today, you can take a Hebrew person of Jewish descent, and you can compare their DNA to any other DNA on the planet, and it does have markers missing that are in all the other races. And occasionally, some of the earmarks of giantism do surface. I'm not just talking about 7'2" Chinese basketball players either. I'm talking about 6 fingers, 6 toes, multiple rows of teeth, as well as the giantism. Occasionally, we will see 6 fingers on one hand, 6 toes on one foot. But it is extremely rare these days to find six fingers on both hands and both feet. It has been a long, long time since this planet has had giants of real giantish genes on the planet, although we do have tall races. All of the characteristics of the giants, cranial cavities twice the size of the average human, and these very large nasal cavities and multiple rows of teeth have long since been bred out. That's one of the things that the giants did not have on this planet is old age. Somebody that's built low to the ground, weighs less than 300 pounds, maybe less than 200 pounds, they could last maybe 100 years on this planet. Gravity is rather forgiving to someone of that weight. But if you weighed 800 pounds or 900 pounds or 1,100 pounds, gravity's not so forgiving. And that's exactly what happened to the giants. They did not age the way we age. They became paralyzed from the waist down, sometimes their arms, sometimes their legs. Because they were considered soulless and they really did not have a salvation, as we have a salvation through the atoning blood of Jesus Christ, they would often commit suicide. And the Bible is full of, especially the Old Testament, full of examples of giants committing suicide, drowning themselves in the sea, drinking poison, and things like that. And the other books, the Kabbalah, the Zohar, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, many of these books also mention the giants and their habits.
Brooks, I have a question.
Yes.
Is there any correlation between the megafauna in the earlier ages of the Earth and these giants? And is that the reason she stated as to why giants are no longer around? Is that there also a correlation to the extinct megafauna?
I don't hold that. What I hold it to is the fact that human tribes took it upon themselves to defeat the giants and rid the planet of them. And you can see even we modern 21st century humans, we're doing a rather good job of extincting species year after year. And these are ones that we really don't know much about.
Yeah.
If we wanted to extinct the giants and we knew their weakness, we could, on concerted effort, we could starve them out.
There you go.
And I think that's exactly what happened. And if you read the Ark of Millions of Years, you can learn more about them than you ever thought possible. And when you finish with those, be sure to pick up Stephen Quayle's books and read those, and you will be so convinced that you'll be wondering why we're not teaching about them in our schools. Well, it's been a marvelous show.
Over.
I'm sorry we only had 1 hour. We could easily go another.
That's the fastest 60 minutes in computer land, eh?
Well, next week, we will be able to take your phone calls. The 800 number will be put up at xsquaredradio.com. You can also find the 800 number at our sponsor and our provider of this service, bbsradio.com. Make sure to go to those websites, and we surely appreciate you listening. And by the way, I want to give a message to Oha, who wrote me over the week, that evidently last week I sounded as though I favored RFID tags, those little chips put under the skin. Actually, I do not favor them. What I was trying to do was make the point that they will be extremely easy to sell the idea, even especially to Americans.
Well, I'd like to have them for my employees.
Yes. I think the nation is just one step away from the mother of all ad campaigns. We're going to eliminate terrorism, drug dealing, counterfeit money, and identity theft all in one fell swoop with this free chip we can put under your skin. Yeah, I think it's pretty frightening. It especially gets frightening when you think about that kind of power in the hands of a political party that never wants to give up its position. Well, Earth Explorers, have a good week and a good weekend. This is your host, Brooks Agnew, saying goodbye. good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.